Welcome to an oral history interview, part of the Media West Oral History Project. I'm George Cole. My guest is Dorothy Eck, and we're in Dorothy's home in Bozeman, Montana. We're recording this oral history on June 5th, the year 2012. Dorothy Eck is 88 years old. Eck is a pioneer for women in Montana politics. She served for 20 years as a Montana state senator representing the Bozeman area. One of her many important legacies is her role in the 1972 Montana Constitutional Convention. We'll talk about that. Dorothy Eck was born in Squim, Washington in 1924. She moved with her husband Hugo to Bozeman in 1946. Dorothy Eck, remember back your childhood years in Washington State?
Those years in Squim were good years. Actually, my family was living on a farm, not much of a farm, a few miles out of Squim. But it was at the place where my father had grown up, and his mother still lived there, had given him the land for the house that he built. Actually, my mother's family had also pioneered in that area. They pioneered down along the river and were flooded out, so the state bought them out, and they ended up happily for her. She wasn't much of a pioneer in Tacoma. But when I was raised, when I was born, there was a broad family of support there, and good, secure life. After maybe a year or so, my father took a full-time job in Squim, and we moved down there. So that after that, the farm, the Fritz Farm, we call it, was a place we visited frequently, but didn't live there.
You know, when we talk about Western Washington, Squim is always considered the banana belt, and it's up near the Olympic Peninsula. Did you graduate from high school in Tacoma or Squim?
No, I graduated from high school in Bremerton. My father had worked for the Union Oil Company. He started out managing their business in Squim and later in Port Townsend and later in Port Angeles, and finally had the whole region there, that northwest region, headquartered in Bremerton. And I graduated from high school in Bremerton. I stayed out of school for a year. My sister had done the same. This was considered to be a wise thing to do. But before the year was out, the war had started, and going to school was difficult. You couldn't get into a dormitory. People told me, come and you can join a sorority, but I had strong feelings about sororities. I didn't want to belong to one. And I was, instead of that, I got married. I was married young. Hugo, my husband, had graduated from Montana State University. He was student body president here, and drum major for the band. And after the war ended, we came back to visit, and they desperately needed teachers. He was an architect. And at that time, architects didn't have advanced degrees. And Dr. Rennie was president. He kept calling, and I was very happy when Hugo accepted the job in Bozeman.
And if I remember correctly, in some notes that I received from the Montana Historical Society, you met Hugo. He was an architect, also served in the Navy, didn't he? And Bremerton still is a large naval base.
Yeah, he didn't serve in the Navy. He was a naval architect. And what happened with being a naval architect, there wasn't any work to do. And he couldn't stand just sitting around at the desk with nothing to do. The job possibility came up in Tacoma, which would be to supervise the building of ships. And that's what he did during the war. And he loved it. Worked very long hours. Had very good experience. But when the war was over, his choices were limited. He would have to, and was offered a job on the East Coast, but no way did he want to move east. Was offered a job by someone in Moses Lake, which didn't sound all appealing to me. So this was good. But he started teaching in architecture. He had graduated in 1941. The war started that last year, which meant that most of the undergraduates that he had gone to school with had gone off either to war or to jobs, and they were now back as students. So it was an interesting situation because Bert Cheever was the only old-time professor here, and the two of them took care of this big load of new students coming in.
I want to go back to your home life with your mom and dad and family in Squim and Tacoma and later Bremerton. What impact did your mother and father have on you, Dorothea, growing up? And were there sisters and brothers in the family?
Yes, I had an older sister, a year and a half older than I was, and we were very close. And then the younger sister, 4.5 years younger. We had a good life there. The amazing thing that happened that I really remember is 1/4 of July. Actually, we had been in Tacoma watching the fireworks, and on the way home, we heard the fire engine go screeching by, and I said, "Oh, could it be our house?" And of course, our house was far away. I stayed on for a week with my cousin and his family in Vashon Island. Had a wonderful week there. And when they drove me home at the end of the week, we got to a little town called Blinn. My aunt and uncle ran the general store there and service station. And we learned that in our absence on the 4th of July, our house had burned down.
Boom.
You know, we had a telephone. I can remember having a telephone in that house that burned down, but no one thought to telephone us. We didn't use the telephone like we do now. It worked out all right because a local dentist had a summer home out on the lake and offered his home for a rental, and we were there for probably a year and a half. And I had good memories of there, of the children that I played with. I can remember one day, we were only maybe 2 blocks from downtown. Squim didn't have much of a downtown. But the word was in that the gypsies were coming. And we all ran home and got weapons, sticks and things, and crawled up on the roof of the garage. Garages were small at that time, and prepared ourselves to fend off the gypsies who didn't come for us.
You know, as you and your husband, Hugo, moved to Montana in 1946, and Hugo to teach architecture here at what was then Montana State College, and of course now is Montana State University, had you been to Montana before, and was this quite a transition for you?
I had been to Montana when I was 8, I think. We took a trip to Yellowstone Park and had good memories of Montana. However, Hugo and most of his friends out in Bremerton who came from Montana were very disparaging about it, as Montana was the last place that most people would want to live. When we came back, it was spring, it snowed, and we took a trip. His family was in Anaconda, and we drove down to Bozeman. I loved it. It was beautiful, just a good feeling. So that transition was very easy for me. I came as a young faculty wife, and there weren't very many young faculty wives until the next year or two. We built a house. There wasn't a house that you could rent in Bozeman. We had a hard time finding a lot that we could build on. They told us most of the area around where we were, which would have been on Garfield going toward Sourdough, and on Wilson and Grand going south, was a swamp. You can't build there. We built a house, moved in. I've had this experience since that time, too. By Christmas, we had the saw out of the living room, I remember. In the meantime, we found Bozeman a very cordial place. There was a formality about it. Women would come calling, and I would greet them in our kind of half-finished house, which was okay. Actually, they were impressed that we were building a house.
As I walked in this morning into this house, the Dorothy Eck House, now in Bozeman, Hugo and Dorothy is still on the door knocker, the name of your husband, who unfortunately died, and we'll talk about that in a few minutes. But this is not the house, or is this the house that you built?
No. No, the house we built is up 1118 South Grand, a duplex. We found that the only way we could get materials to build a house was if we agreed to rent half of it to veterans. We're seeing a bit of that kind of thing now. And as it happened, Hugo had a cousin and his younger brother and all of their friends who were veterans. So they lived upstairs in the house. We lived down. They would come down for coffee almost every night. We had built-in babysitters. My sister came to school that year, and Hugo's sister was also here. So that was a good family situation.
You mentioned earlier that, first of all, it was maybe a hard time, a difficult time to go on to college for you right after high school, and you didn't want to join a sorority. Early stirrings of maybe a social conscience that we'll definitely get to, but had you gone to college right out of high school, or did that come later in your life?
It came later. My intent was to stay out and work for a year. My sister had done that, and then she went to Stanford and was there until the war kind of pushed her up to the University of Washington. So when I came to Bozeman, I didn't have college at all. And I had intended to enroll in Tacoma. My mother had gone to college there, College of Puget Sound, but found it was almost impossible to get from where we lived in Tacoma to the college because of gas. You couldn't drive your car, and the bus lines didn't work well. And before long, I was pregnant, and I had two children while we still were in Tacoma. So when I arrived in Bozeman, I had two children. And when we decided to build in this house, we had thought about it for quite a while and had managed to get this lot, which was sold by Langer, who did the lots on down the street, but considered this lot as inappropriate because there wasn't any space for an alley. That didn't bother us much. So we bought the lot. My father came out and worked with Hugo, and the two of them pretty much built the whole house.
What year was this? And it's a beautiful house, just to describe it. You can almost tell that an artist or an architect designed it because it has beautiful lines. And also, as you look out the window, as I'm doing now, a beautiful, more than a backyard. It's a garden. It's surrounded by broadleaf and also some pine trees across the way. When did you build this house?
It was in the early 50s, and when we built the house, all this garden and trees and things out here was a baseball field. That's what the kids used it for. And at the end of it was a pond where children all over town would come. There was a raft on it. And later, when they decided to turn it into apartments, I told them that by cutting down all those trees around the pond, it would really affect the flow of water. And it did. They had built apartments next to us here. And the very next day, their basements were full of water, whole streams running into it. And they have since installed a big system of sump pumps.
We're doing an oral history. My guest is Dorothy Eck, and we're at her home in Bozeman. Dorothy Eck, as we record this interview in June of 2012, is 88 years old. Let's finish a couple chapters before we go on to your early involvement with the League of Women Voters, and on we go to the State Constitutional Convention in 72 and the Montana State Senate. But you mentioned two children. Just describe for me a daughter I know, Diana Eck.
And Diana, and we know about Diana, and my son was Lawrence Eck. He was an attorney, marvelous attorney, and did good work. And unfortunately, he had bipolar, and really, it didn't appear until maybe he was in his 30s, but it really messed up his life from then on. I was thinking about politically, you might be interested in that my first political campaign I can remember was when I was maybe four, and there was the matter of a Catholic running for president. And I can remember
Al Smith.
Yeah, I can remember being asked if I was a Catholic, and I said, no, I'm a Swede. And that was pretty much the identity I had at that time. My folks were not at all interested politically. I mean, we knew what was going on, but they didn't take a political role at all, and neither did I until I was in high school, and my very good friend's father was the editor of the newspaper. By then, I was skeptical of Republicans. But on the other hand, I really remember listening to the campaign for Wilkie. It was very exciting to me how it was the fact that the people were the ones that really took control in electing him. And we would sit there, you know, they didn't have good accounting of what was that going on. We had to keep our own little notes on who was ahead and what was it going to take to nominate him.
So you early on got into the numbers game of politics, and it's appropriate that we are recording this oral history on primary election day, June 5th, 2012, with Dorothy Eck. Just to close at least a portion of a chapter, Dr. Diana Eck, Dorothy's daughter, is on the faculty at Harvard University, and if I remember correctly, unfortunately, your son has died. But complete the story with Dr. Diana Eck and what she is doing today.
Well, what she's doing is marvelous work. She teaches comparative religion. She loves that. She took her junior year in India, so she has had an interest in India and in the religions of the world. And what she found in teaching was that more and more she was getting students who came from different religious backgrounds, but who had grown up in the United States, and they didn't know very much about what really was their own religion. She has a project she calls the Pluralism Project, where she's had students all over the country reporting in on the diversity of religious activities in their areas. It's one that she really likes a lot. She's married a woman, Dorothy Austin, who is the associate minister of the Harvard Memorial Church. They're one big church at Harvard. They had a huge wedding. They didn't really plan it to be huge, but but it became that. And the interesting thing is that they have not, the only really critical remarks about this lesbian couple being the masters of Lowell House, which is one of the big traditional houses at Harvard, the only criticism came from a London tabloid. They've done well there. And she likes especially the association with undergraduates there.
I've had a chance to talk with her for radio programs I've done, and Dr. Diane Eck is not only a wonderful professional woman, but a wonderful person. Also, since we're kind of walking around college campuses here, before we get into the political life of Dorothy Eck, talk to us a bit about your when you did go back to college and kind of the circumstances of all of that. And I know that you have an honorary PhD from Montana State University here in Bozeman.
Well, I started back to college. I think I looked at it more as recreation than anything else. I'd take night classes. We had a wonderful professor, Dr. Lauer, who had been expelled from the University of Chicago for being too liberal. But he had night classes and read books. And the other association I made during that time was that our famous potter here, I have problems with names.
I do too. Go right ahead.
Was in that class. And, in fact, two artists that I maintained associations with for a long time. As the years went by, I found I could not just take night classes. If I heard about a good class or a good professor, I could sign up for his classes. It was cheap. It seemed to me it would cost $6 or $8 per credit. And that was good to the point where I agreed that maybe I should look at getting a degree. I had a lot of credits, and they never knew where to put me. And so I did. I finished up in education. Actually, I had always been opposed to buying life insurance. So this was partly, I said, that instead of having life insurance, I'd have a degree so I could teach. I didn't really think I ever would.
So you have an undergraduate degree and a master's, is that?
Yes, I got my undergraduate degree in sociology and went on to get my master's. And I was in a situation where I had a lot of classes in psychology and also in sociology. And neither the professors didn't trust one another much. The sociology professors were sure that the philosophy of the psychologists teaching here were too rigid. And then I had classes in religion and philosophy. And neither the sociologist or the psychologist considered philosophy a acceptable program. It wasn't scientific. So my master's degree was kind of focused on that, along with how people really secure their identity.
This is an oral history interview with Dorothy Eck of Bozeman, a former state senator, a leader in women's rights. She served 20 years in the Montana State Senate. She was elected in 1980, retired from the Senate in 2000. Dorothy Eck was elected to the Montana Constitutional Convention in 1972. We'll get there in just a moment. And we're recording this oral history June 5th, 2012, at her home in Bozeman. Dorothy Eck 88 years old. I do want to ask you one more question about your husband, Hugo. How many years did he teach here on the campus?
He taught 32 years. And I think after he retired, he still would teach one class at a time. But he did a lot of architectural practice also, more so than any of the other professors. And he was very much influenced by Richard Neutra. From early on, I think that, you know, you commented on the looks of our house, and I think you see some similarity to Neutra's philosophy of what a house should be. People say it looks like Frank Lloyd Wright, and they were contemporaries.
Now, what year did Hugo die?
Oh, yeah, 88, I think it was.
Here's Dorothy Eck today in 2012, and as you drive up to her front yard, you see political signs for Obama, Tester, Bullock, and everyone knows she's a Democrat, a liberal Democrat. And Dorothy, you can correct me on that if I misuse the word liberal.
Not at all. I like being called liberal.
When did it happen, Dorothy Eck, when you got the stirrings to get involved with public life, political life?
I think when I first came to Bowes, when I realized it was a very Republican place and that I didn't agree with the Republicans here. Their main issue was get us out of the United Nations. And I had, you know, from high school days, been supporting the United Nations. And I found that there was a group starting here to support the United Nations. And that was initially the political group that I belonged to. We had regular meetings, good speakers. We had one coup where one of the Republicans' congressional candidates took a trip to South America with some extension agents and came back a big supporter of foreign aid, a lot of issues that the Republicans were against. And we had him as our prime speaker the next year. We also, it was that time that we had Eleanor Roosevelt visit Bozeman, which was good. I didn't become involved in the Democratic Party because during this time I was also starting to work with the League of Women Voters and found that any political ties were not really accepted there. So it wasn't actually until I ran as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention that I ran as a Democrat.
And that was 1972, and we'll get there in just a second. I want to go back to Eleanor Roosevelt for just a moment. I think this was in the 1950s, maybe early 50s, and the college refused to have her speak on campus?
Yes, they did. She spoke, I think, at Wilson School, and the local Republicans were so pleased because they managed to have her sitting in a red chair. But it was a day that people remembered, really quite a coup for Bozeman.
And to this day, the League of Women Voters is nonpartisan. And so that was intriguing, though, that, you know, you really didn't identify yourself as a Democrat because you served three terms as state president, didn't you, of the League of Women Voters? And then you identified yourself as a Democrat, legitimately, in 72.
Now, I don't know that I served three terms, but as president of the League of Women Voters, I certainly did not identify myself as a Democrat. However, it was during that time where I lobbied the legislature. The League was the first citizen group who had full-time lobbyists at the legislature. And we learned a lot about what was wrong with the legislature and what needed to be done, and became strong supporters, of course, of having a constitutional convention.
what was wrong with the Montana State Legislature, the smoke-filled rooms, literally, in those days, the deals, the copper company, the power company, and some would say on the other side of the street, big labor. But in your opinion, Dorothy Eck, before the Constitutional Convention in 72, not that everything has been cured, but what was wrong with the state legislature?
Well, what was wrong with the state legislature? It was really run by the big corporations. My first knowledge of this really was when we rented one summer when the students were gone from our apartment to a group of women, one of them a Republican woman reporter who had covered the legislature and who explained in detail how the corporations managed to control everything that went on, including who ran for office. They would have a Republican and a Democrat running. They were both their people. And being at the legislature, realizing that everything was done in secret, you could not attend a meeting with a committee meeting where they were making decisions. They were made in private. The second reading votes, which are critical, were made without any report. We had to have people, we joined with others, and we'd have people sitting in the balcony, and each one of us would have four or five legislators to watch whether they had green buttons or red. And that was the only way we could tell how people were voting. It was a very controlled situation. And the newspapers also were pretty much controlled by the corporations. Bozeman Daily Chronicle was not. However, you know, coming here in a presidential election year and finding almost no political news in the newspaper, the front page would have stories about who was running for prom queen. It was obvious that the change was desperately needed.
In years past, the Anaconda Copper Company was one of the controlling factors of the major daily newspapers in Billings, Missoula, Butte, and Helena. And like you said, in those years, the Bozeman Daily Chronicle was one of the independents. But now, as we speak in 2012, they're owned by a corporation out of Seattle, too. So the media battle continues. But the stirrings for a state constitutional convention, even in 1972, post the 1960s, almost unheard of that a state, an entire state, would come together and there would be a call for a constitutional convention. Give us some of the history behind this, Dorothy Eck, about how and why did this happen, because many different interests, many different cities.
I don't think that the League was entirely responsible, but I think the League had a good role in calling attention to the fact that changes had to be made. But there were others who wanted changes also. Our former Constitution would only, you could put three items at a time on the ballot. So in order to get a change, any major change, was going to take years. I think one of the strong influence was the fact that Butte Silverbow really wanted to become a city-county organization, which made great sense for them. And they had tried to get it on as a constitutional amendment, allowing them to do that, but knew it wasn't going to work. And so they became a strong supporter of a constitutional convention. Other organizations, there was an organization of attorneys who wanted to see changes in the judicial system. And from localities around the state, there were organizations that wanted more rights, really, for local government. So that we weren't the only one. And they first called, they were able to get an amendment or a legislation in setting up a commission to look at our present Constitution to see how much of it was detrimental, how much of it really didn't matter, and what parts were really good. Well, that commission came up with the recommendation that too much of it was really detrimental, made it difficult to really pass reasonable laws, to have reasonable government.
Now, if I remember correctly, there were approximately 100 delegates to the Constitutional Convention. It was in 1972. And did these come from legislative districts, or what was the makeup? They were elected people like yourself who went to Helena for this meeting, this convention.
It was set up to follow the way the legislature was organized at the time. And at that time, you had multi-seat districts, so that Bozeman was part of a district made up of Gallatin and Park County, and we had 6 seats. There were 30 people filed for those 6 seats. It was required that you run, that it be a partisan race, and it was. The way it happened, during the time that the campaign was going on, there was a tremendous amount of education being done, because the legislature, after calling for a convention and finding that the people voted for a convention, then established a commission to set up the process for the legislature, and they hired some wonderful young people to do the studies. And candidates during that time had a lot of material to study. They put out booklets, and here at the university they had a class on what a constitutional convention might be. Larry Pettit ran that class and had a number of students there, as well as people who were candidates to become delegates. So we had learned a lot before the convention actually was called. And actually about maybe 8, quite a few of the students came over and worked at the convention as interns.
When did you first meet Max Baucus? Was this the time?
Yes. He came looking for a job. I was on the committee actually that hired him, the executive committee, and I remember talking to him, and he was very open about the fact that he had come back to Montana after graduating from law school and having a few years working elsewhere, and he wanted to get into politics. He really wanted to be a U.S. senator. People really gasped at that and said,
and even then he knew he wanted to be a senator.
Yes. But they said, well, you know, you shouldn't say that. That's too presumptive. And, you know, we thought it was great. And we gave him good advice about the best place to run would be from Missoula. At that time, there was a great interest in doing door-to-door work. And he did that. He went back, and there was a multi-county district that was running for the legislature, and he walked his district, and I think he came in first with out of a pretty large slate of candidates.
So he did serve in, like, the state legislature before he went back to the U.S. Congress?
Yeah, he served in the state and then ran for Congress. He wasn't the choice of the in-group of Democrats. I can remember Mansfield calling them the Montana Mafia, who really liked to select who was going to run. And he was not their selection, but he won.
So many things to talk about. Let's go back to the Constitutional Convention. So you actually met, you and your colleagues, in 1972. What was the atmosphere like at the meeting? Did it last 3 months, 6 months? How long was the convention?
Oh, it lasted 58 days.
So here the delegates were elected to the Constitutional Convention, meeting in Helena, 58 days. A lot of work to do. But you mentioned earlier that, you know, you ran as either a Democrat or a Republican. Can you remember approximately how many Democrats and how many Republicans were actually the elected delegates to the convention?
I don't remember exactly, but I do remember that the Democrats had a strong majority. I would say 58% to 60%. And that the state Democrats, the official party, wanted us to organize a Democratic convention. And there was enough support, enough understanding that it had to be nonpartisan if it were to be successful, that was resisted. And although they called for a caucus of Democrats and Republicans, when those caucuses occurred, they were short. It had already been pretty well agreed that the Democrats would have the chair and Republicans vice chair, and the same kind of split would be made in committee chairs.
So on the 58th day, did you have a document? Was it a proposed constitution? What happened?
Not at all. I don't think there was any sympathy for the proposal that we just take the old constitution and make amendments. And actually, the call for citizen participation was tremendous. We had had ads in the paper where citizens could write out proposals of something they wanted in the Constitution. They were all filed, assigned to a committee, and they were all heard. So that really, from the beginning, it was established that each committee would work on what they wanted their article to say. I was on Bill of Rights Committee, and we had a lot of good ideas of what our article should say.
You said on the 58th day it wasn't all said and done, and I would assume that you were looking down the road that this constitution, this proposed document that would affect every county in the state of Montana, would have to go to the voters. And did it require a simple majority? And kind of walk us through what happened there with the eventual approval.
Yes, it requires a simple majority. And we were aware of this. There were a lot of issues that came up in proposals that the Constitutional Convention delegates favored, but they didn't put them in because it might alienate a group of voters that they were going to need. And as it happened, we did have some side issues like gambling that where we put on a separate ballot as to whether or not it should be there. Once the Constitution was signed, and every delegate signed it, even those who had strong opinions against it, Betty Babcock signed it. And when she found that her husband and a group of his cohorts were making plans on how they were going to defeat it, she went to work full-time supporting it. She was one of the strongest supporters. She and Daphne Bugby traveled the state, a Democrat and a Republican, really working on this.
Of course, Betty Babcock, the wife of Tim Babcock, former governor of the state of Montana, and an active Republican, and Daphne Bugby, at that time based in Missoula and a very activist Democrat in the Garden City. The document, how many days did you go before you had this written document that you were going to submit to the voters?
We went 58 days. And we had in mind all along that we were going to need extra time, or we want to save the extra money that the next 2 days would cost to promote the Constitution. So we adjourned early, and the court didn't allow us to have the money. And we didn't have a lot of money, but we were able to get enough support. And really, the delegates then spent the time between when we adjourned in mid-March was until the primary in June, and we wisely put it on the primary ballot, and we had that time to campaign for it, and most of the delegates spent most of their time campaigning.
Can you remember the numbers when the election night was drawing near midnight? What were the – it passed, obviously, but what were the numbers?
You know, it didn't pass so obviously.
Oh, and, really?
In fact, there were questions, and the question was whether it needed the majority of the votes cast or the majority of the votes cast on that particular issue, thinking that there are a lot of people who voted for gambling but didn't bother to vote at all on whether they approved the Constitution. Anderson was governor at the time. He knew this debate was going on, and he knew that there were people who were waiting to challenge it, and he had the document written out that he had received the results of the election and the Constitution had passed. And he took that down to the Secretary of State's office, and there were some shenanigans then, but they had to accept it. But even after that, it was challenged, you know, all the way to the Supreme Court. So that we weren't sure right away that it had passed.
Challenge to the Montana Supreme Court?
The U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, really?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did they hear and pass down a judgment?
Yes, they did. They passed down the judgment that it had properly passed. Mm-hmm.
I was living out of state at the time and wasn't really aware of all of the implications of what was going on. And I remember, even though I did come back and, in disclosure, worked for the local government study commission in Helena for a while after the Constitution had been passed, but I remember some of the significant things to me, Dorothy Eck, were that, number one, single-member legislative districts where you would not have countywide or legislators elected from a broad geographic area, that there were single-member legislative districts. And there also was a part of the Constitution that required local government review, where incorporated cities, incorporated counties would have to go to their people, to the people who lived in that particular city, and propose an alternative to their current form of government, like if it was a city manager form or strong mayor. Just talk about some of the implications of this Constitution. And, of course, you were on the Bill of Rights Committee as well.
Yeah, that was important. And the local governments were important in calling a Constitution to begin with. I can remember, you know, the statements is that local governments should not be shackled because the law had required for many issues that the legislature decided what local governments could and could not do. So they had a lot more flexibility. We were disappointed that they didn't really use it as well as much as they should. And that's still a possibility. There are still people in this county who are wanting a change to a different form of county government, and maybe eventually they'll get it, and they have a way of looking at it. But this was true very much in the way that state government worked, the way the legislature worked. The governor was given a mandatory veto, which he hadn't had before, and we still see that that's effective. The judicial system is still up in questions. There were strong feelings that the judiciary should be appointed and not elected. And I think we still see that happening. And the matter of annual sessions. The convention was sure that we should do that, but the people decided they didn't want annual sessions.
Was this also the time that term limits were put into effect for, like, all the elected offices at state level?
Term limits, that was a constitutional amendment that came later, and it was one of those amendments that was made throughout a lot of states. It's understandable why people would think that this is a good idea. After serving in the legislature, and I did that for a lot of years, I could see, you know, the advantages. There were always, you know, a few doddery old legislators who weren't of much use. But on the other hand, we could also see with term limits, you lose the leadership you need, and there's a lot more power going to the lobbyists.
We're recording an oral history interview with Dorothy Eck, and we're in Bozeman at her home. And Dorothy Eck is a former state senator, a leader in women's rights to this day in Montana. She served 20 years in the Montana State Senate, elected in 1980, retired in 2000, and as we discussed just a few moments ago, was very active in the 1972 Constitutional Convention. Let's go now to your active political years in the state Senate and the forming of a legacy, really, that you have done so much in public life. What, in your mind, as you served in the Montana State Senate, were some of the highlights of things that you are especially proud of?
Oh, there are a lot of areas I worked in. I think children and families is one that I still think back on, that where we did good work, and there's a lot more to be done. I was especially interested, and still am, in proposals for in-home visiting. We had had good reports from states, starting with Hawaii, who had done this, and Vermont is a marvelous example, where they have reduced child abuse to, by 50% at least, by giving this kind of help to families in their homes. I also was a part of a lot of environmental issues related to coal mining, and that was also related to taxes. And I think one of the reasons that we proposed and had accepted a high tax on coal was the understanding that the costs to the communities and to the state of that development was really high.
How has the state of Montana done as being a steward of its natural resources? And we see the increasing number of coal trains that are going out of Montana for export of coal to Asia and certainly to the west and east coasts of our own country. But how are we doing with the whole stewardship issue of our natural resources?
I think it's still an issue and always will be. I think during those early years, we realized the potential cost to local governments and to the state of this kind of development. And we're still seeing this, that there are costs. In many ways, it's helped us having the coal tax as a reserve fund that we really rely on. We can only spend the income from it, but that income is important to the state in managing a lot of important programs. We are especially aware now that gas development is becoming a major issue in eastern Montana, and those communities have not been able to keep up with the demands. And the demands of longer and longer and more coal railroad cars going through our cities is an issue that most communities have not really been able to prepare for.
We mentioned a few moments ago your early friendship and advice that you gave to now very senior U.S. Senator Max Baucus. And then as I was reading notes of your papers with the Montana Historical Society, I know that you worked as a local government liaison person when Tom Judge was governor of Montana. And, of course, correct me if I'm wrong, you shared an office in the state Senate with John Tester, who is now the U.S. senator. close friend of Dorothy Bradley, who served in the state legislature and, of course, ran in a race for governor. So many things to talk about. The legacy of Dorothy Eck in Montana politics, very strong. And if one was to define the principles of Dorothy Eck, what would they be?
You know, one of the issues I worked with on the Bill of Rights was the right to know. And I still feel very strongly about that. That's one of the reasons I am so much opposed to the Citizens United case, is that it does not provide transparency to who is paying for all of the ads that are being heard over TV and elsewhere. That's important to me. And I mentioned before that children and families are important to me, that families should be strong families. Children should not have to grow up in dysfunctional families. But rather than taking the children away, the better way of dealing this was helping the family to become more of a functional family. And I think I'm still concerned about this, and I'm still concerned about local government issues. I think strong city and county governments are really important, and maybe we don't pay enough attention to them.
And you've been very active here in Bozeman and Gallatin County with the issue of mental health. You've talked just a moment ago about the strength of the family, but isn't there a facility here in the city of Bozeman that you played a vital part in just making it happen?
Oh, over a lot of years. You know, going way back maybe 30, 40 years, when our county commissioners affirmed that we didn't have any mentally ill people here, and that they considered that programs to work with the mentally ill were really a communist front. It wasn't until we got Jane Jelinski, I think, as a county commissioner, that they started looking at the mentally ill as a real problem and as one that we can do something about. I've had my voice in that. Early on, I discovered that Missoula was doing a marvelous job in coming up with facilities to deal with the mentally ill. This mostly because my good friend lobbying with the League of Women Voters, Daphne Bugby, by then Daphne Bugby Jones, had been on their board and told me about the great things they had and the support they received to develop these programs in Missoula. And shortly after that, our local group looked at the situation, decided Missoula could do better for us than Billings was doing, and joined up with them. And we have really developed a very good campus here for taking care of mentally ill patients.
Women in politics, from day one in the early 50s when you got actively involved with the League of Women Voters. But how would you give a scorecard these days to both the Democrat Party and the Republican Party in the state of Montana? And you can go national if you want, about the role of women and the impact, perhaps more important, the impact that women have had on our political process.
Oh, I think it's obvious. Tom Judge had said I was the first woman to be on the governor's staff. I'm not sure that that's really true, but while I was there, two of the women who had worked with me in League of Women Voters on the state level became department chairs. And right now, you look at Montana's major positions, and there are an awful lot of them held by women. I think that is basically because women are doing a really good job. Now, whether it's Republican or Democratic, I think it's interesting that those who look at the basic differences between the party look at the Republicans as supporting the kind of management from the top down, the strong father. This is true in government and in families, where the wife takes a minor role, is expected to be obedient, as are the children expected to be obedient, and that is their structure. Whereas the democratic structure is more a structure where the family is supportive, where the children and the wives and the husband come together as a unit that helps one another. And I think that this is true in political life, and I think we see a lot of that in the issues that we're facing today on the war on women. It's a matter of whether they can have women take their proper role as the Republicans would like them and being submissive to men. And, women are not likely to do this. I think this is true in the fact that our young people tend to be more Democratic than Republicans, and it might be that the young people will change the position of Republicans also.
There are so many social issues, hot button social issues, that are part of this political year 2012 and yet to be seen what will happen. And as we conclude this interview, Dorothy Eck, any regrets, anything that you might have done differently, any thoughts about what might have been?
No, I don't have much regrets about what I've done. I think maybe I ought to kind of more quietly bow out, because it seems that there are always jobs to be done. I keep thinking, this one last campaign, if we're able to come through and win this, and I think we can if we really make sure all those Democrats really vote, that's what I'm working on. I am maybe willing to take it easy a little more. But I've always said politics is really a disease, and once you get into it and you can understand that you still have a possibility of making a difference, I think that's where I'll be.
And you're an optimist, because I've seen you not only in Bozeman but in Helena and so many other places as well. You truly are an optimist about what can happen.
Yeah, that's right. But I'm not an optimist in that it just will happen. You really have to plan for it. And although I can remember having one little sign on my desk, and it said plan, and that was crossed out, and it said scheme.
And at age 88, you're using oxygen. Some of the discerning listeners can perhaps hear the oxygen machine in the background. How are you feeling? How's life?
Well, the oxygen is a nuisance. But on the other hand, I have learned to get by with it. And I know that I could go to either Boston, Cambridge, where my daughter is, or to the Olympic Peninsula, where a good bit of my family still resides, and I don't need oxygen there. But for the time being, at least, my life is here, and I'm willing to put up with the oxygen.
For those of you who are not privy with elevation figures, Bozeman stands at 4,900 feet, I think, and then, of course, the Olympic Peninsula, and I would imagine Harvard and Boston close to sea level.
That's right. It makes a big difference. It even makes a difference between here and Missoula, say. I used to say in Helena, although I still need a little oxygen in Helena.
Well, Dorothy Eck, it's been a pleasure talking with you, and keep on planning and keep on scheming.
Thank you. You couldn't stop me.